Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I am really excited, maybe even more than usual today, because we are going to be doing a new series on ACRAC where we're going to be interviewing some master clinicians. So what does that mean? It means that we're trying to identify people at different institutions who their colleagues and their trainees identify them as really somebody that they would go to for a question they might have about how to do something clinically, someone they really value their expertise and advice, someone who's just very good clinically, who people think, yeah, like if I had to have my surgery or my epidural or whatever it is done, I would want that person to do it. And I'm going to be interviewing them and asking them to talk about some of the things they've picked up over the years, some of the things they recommend that they would teach, that they would really counsel other people to keep in mind. And so one of those people right here at Hopkins is a great friend and colleague of mine, Dr. Dave Berman. And I've asked him to come on the show to be one of these master clinicians. Now, this wasn't just me thinking that Dave is excellent, though, of course, I do think that. But Dave is really somebody who our trainees and other faculty really think of, both in the general operating room area, but also in his subspecialty area of OB anesthesia, as being clinically excellent. I've seen that myself in times I've gotten to work with him where we've been both involved in a case, and I've certainly heard it from many of my colleagues, faculty, as well as from our trainees. And so I'm excited to bring Dave on to talk about his clinical expertise and what he would recommend that you all keep in mind as you build your own clinical expertise. Dave, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be back, and thank you for talking with me about a really important topic. For full disclosure, you called me and came up to me and talked to me about this idea for a series about master clinicians, and I was all for it. I feel like I've learned a ton from my numerous master clinicians throughout my training, starting when I was a paramedic student in New York in the immediate post 9/11 era, and then through medical school and residency and fellowship, and certainly as a young attending. I thought hearing from master clinicians and how they got where they were clinically sounded like a fantastic idea. And then you threw a wrench into the whole thing and you asked me to be featured. And I immediately assumed that you had made a mistake. We all struggle with some degree of imposter syndrome, but especially for something like this, I can't really shake the feeling that you asked me by accident. But it's your podcast and you think I'm worth listening to. So let's do this thing. I feel like I've been lucky to have a ton of great mentors and a lot of idols along the way. And I'm going to start by mentioning three big phrases that hint at the core of what I'm about as a clinician and an educator. Hopefully it's helpful to listeners to hear a bit of an underlying principles-based approach. And then we can talk about what this means in action. How does that sound to you?
Yeah, that sounds fabulous. And I just want to say, you know, your point about imposter syndrome is well taken. I think really important. I think so many, maybe all of us have this. I certainly, every time someone says to me that they like and listen to the podcast, I think, you know, that can't be this podcast. You know, I mean, I just think we all have it. And yet, especially our trainees don't realize that they're not the only one. So the more we hear people like you who are well, you know, into your career, you have a long way to go still, but, you know, who have certainly established themselves, say that you still have that and I still have that. I think it helps our trainees and it's really important. So I'm glad you pointed that out. So I am excited to hear these three phrases that you mentioned. Let's start with the first one.
Yeah. So the first one comes from Steve Jobs when he gave his legendary 2005 Stanford commencement address. Steve Jobs was, by all accounts, a complicated individual. He was creative, but also prone to bouts of anger and impulsivity. But if there's one thing he certainly was, it is a visionary. He had the vision to make the personal computer into what it is, made the courageous decision to take keyboards off of smartphones in the BlackBerry era, and saw far into the future of personal devices. I'm not a cultist by any stretch, though I suppose most cultists would say that they are not cultists. But I've grown up with a reverence for Apple and for its emphasis on how they pursue elegance in design. They make the most technologically challenging things easy. I think about it when I'm setting up my iPhone to mirror on my Apple TV. It's an amazing, amazing amount of power and technology that goes into it. But my seven-year-old knows how to set it up. I know you and I are both big believers in the Apple ecosystem. I'm preaching to the choir here. In his 2005 commencement address, talked about one of the phrases that was brought to his life and brought his life into focus. And it was a quote from the Whole Earth Catalog. This was a catalog that was fantastic, especially for its time. It was sort of like the Reddit, before anything else. On the back cover of the last issue, once the creator had realized that the publication had sort of run its course, there was a photo of an early morning country road. And above the photo were the words, "Stay hungry, stay foolish." Steve Jobs was so fond of saying that he wished that for those around him, they should stay hungry and stay foolish. And it's something I've tried to embody as a clinician since early in my training. And we can talk more about how that is practically embodied later.
Yeah, great. Before we move on to the next one, I just want to point out that ACRAC is not supported in any way by Apple, though Apple, if you are listening, we're open to those discussions. So feel free to reach out. I also want to just say to those listening that if you're hearing this and you're thinking, you know, I have someone at my institution who is totally that person, that master clinician, and I want them to be featured, please send us an email, acracpodcast@gmail.com, and let us know what institution you're at, who the person is, and we will look into it. And if other folks at your institution agree that this is really a master clinician, we may invite them to be part of this series on ACRAC. All right. So, Dave. Stay hungry, stay foolish. I love it. Let's hear the next one.
The next one is talking about the source of wisdom. Early on, when I was a young and enterprising college student, I had significantly more hair. And I was a little obsessed with finding out a unifying source of wisdom. I took some classes in philosophy. I read Mill and Locke and Freud and Jung and lots of other luminary thinkers. And I tried to find a source for wisdom as one of these optimistic college kids. I thought it was in the library. And then I realized that some of the dumbest people I'd met were very well-read. And some of the smartest I'd met weren't seemingly well-educated on paper. That's not to say that education is meaningless, far from it, but rather that there isn't one sole source of wisdom. And I feel like I've gained a ton of depth and understanding in the last few decades, both as a physician, but also as a husband, a dad, a brother, a son, simply by asking people their stories and experiences and then sitting down to listen. It's one of those things which brings me a ton of joy on the labor floor. I do their spinal for a C-section, and then I hear about how a family was brought together. I get to know their story and how they brought a new bundle of joy into the world. The challenges, the hardships, the defining moments in their lives. I feel like I've met some truly fantastic people over the years. Certainly many rich and famous over the course of my training and otherwise. But the conversations I remember the most are those with ordinary people who recount their stories in their journals. There was a project that was popular for a while called The Humans of New York by Brandon Stanton. And I loved that project because I got to see the remarkable depth and breadth of experiences in normal people around us. And I felt like that was transformative. So my second phrase is, wisdom is found in the most unexpected of places. I feel like I've learned more from normal people than I have from celebrities.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, I tell our medical students on the critical care clerkship that they have this unique opportunity to spend some significant time with patients and families that they may not have as much time for when they're trainees. And that you just never know how much you will learn if you just go in there and just ask them. Let's say the patient can't speak and you're asking the family, you know, tell me about them. What did they do for a living? What did they, do they have children? Who, tell me their story. And you not only learn a ton and things that you never would have guessed, but also the impact that has on a patient and family is incredible. So I love that message of spend time, ask for the stories. You never know what you're going to learn.
Yeah. And my last is that life is all about relationships. I saw a bumper sticker a long time ago that said, there's no I in team, but there is a me if you're dyslexic. And I just loved that. My grandfather was a Holocaust survivor. He was a true polymath. He was a fluent in half a dozen languages, a respected electrical engineer, and he was also a legendary prankster. I won't tell you which one of those are hereditary, but Jed, I think you know which I have gotten from him.
I'm not surprised at all.
Yeah. One of the things that he would always talk about was the importance of connecting with those around you, and not just the superficial connections, like people's names, which we'll talk about later, but the bigger and broader aspects of who people are. And this ties in with the above. One of the major figures in the School of Medicine at Hopkins is famous for saying something along the same lines. He says that you can be the world's best clinician or researcher, but without relationships to those around you, it's all for naught. A focus on relationships is the real thing I've noticed among clinicians I've come to respect over time. The truly outstanding ones aren't just focused on getting the stent in the coronary or the tube in the trachea. They're focused on doing so while building a shared mental model with those around them. Simon Sinek, who's a tech evangelist, is famous for saying that a team isn't a group of people who work together. A team is a group of people who trust each other. And the important scholarly work of Amy Edmondson, who's at the Harvard Business School, who writes a lot about teaming, has certainly shown that that's true in medicine. I've been lucky enough to do some really cool cases at Hopkins. I've done a couple of first-in-human clinical things over the course of the last decade or so, but it's always been done in the context of a team. When the late Dr. Jillian Isaac, who I know was a mentor to both you and me, would interview residency applicants, her first question would always be, "Tell me the origin of your name." It was an amazing way to get to know someone's story that wasn't often told in interviews. She picked up on so many things about our applicants that the rest of us didn't get simply because she asked the question. So I would encourage all of our listeners to ask the question. And some of my highest pressure experiences I've had as an attending are when being asked to take care of our nurses, our residents, or our attending physicians when they are patients and when they're having surgery or delivering a kiddo. It's always a reminder to me that relationships among colleagues really do matter, and that building up that trust among those around you will pay dividends for decades to come.
Yeah, 100%. The difference between working in a team you trust with people you enjoy being with and not is light and night and day. I don't know that anyone has been able to kind of quantify this, but I bet if you could, you would see a direct correlation with burnout. If you're going to work every day with people you trust, who you care about, who you know care about you, who you enjoy being around, who you take that relationship not just within work, but you know about their families and their kids, that I bet correlates with a reduction in burnout. Whereas if you don't have that, it would shock me if it wasn't correlated with burnout. So I agree with you. That's so crucial.
So it's funny you should say that, because I will occasionally get assignments that would generally be considered maybe less than desirable in the main OR. I'm doing the toe amputations and whatever. But as long as I'm with a great team, none of that seems to matter. I would choose that any day over another case that's sexy and cool, but with a team I don't necessarily particularly enjoy working with.
100%. So these kind of three phrases you mentioned and these lessons are really important. And how do you fit that into being a clinician? How do you make those connections?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. I think for our listeners, you've probably been wondering at this point how all of this fits in, right? And I'll tell you that in all honesty, all the stuff we've talked about is stuff that I do think about a lot when practicing medicine. It's how I approach my clinical experiences and how I approach being an educator and also my being a dad. And Jed, I know that you can agree with me on this, that the being a dad is probably the hardest and also the simultaneously most rewarding job I have. A close analog to that being someone who helps mentor residents along their process. I feel like the skill set is pretty similar.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So from my early clinical training, as an EMT, as a paramedic student, I sought out the tough cases and the tough assignments. When I was a paramedic student, I would often ask the crew if I could stay far beyond my allotted time during clinical rotations. So if we brought a patient into the ED for a trauma and my shift was over, I would ask if I could put on some paper scrubs and go to the trauma OR. When we would have patients who would have an MI on their kitchen floor, I wouldn't just bring them to the ED. I would try and follow them to the cath lab. I wanted to see what people were doing. I wanted to see what the team was doing, and I wanted to see what the patient was experiencing. I certainly didn't know most of the medicine at that stage of my training, but I was really hungry for that clinical experience in a way that I was always told was a little abnormal. I've had an insatiable curiosity for clinical care since early on, and I've tried my best to keep that forward throughout my career. When I was a CA2 on my peds cardiac anesthesia rotation, I watched our pediatric cardiology and interventionalist placing a PICC line in a premature baby's popliteal vein. And as a resident, as a new attending, I'd really watch closely how our IR folks would gain vascular access for their cases. And it's how I learned to do my central lines in plane rather than out of plane. And I think I'm probably the only attending in our department who regularly does so. It's also how I learned to do supraclavicular, subclavian central lines, which is something I've adopted to my practice when handling challenging access scenarios. And these things don't happen often. It's not common that I'll put in a popliteal IV, but I found wisdom in those unexpected places. I feel like my toolbox gets bigger the more I shop around. So one time I was in an all-day-long spine, and I thought I'd secured enough access. It was one of those thoraco, lumbo, sacral, T4 to sacrum, re-fusions. I put in a 14 and a 16 and an A-line, and unfortunately, prone, arms tucked in the middle of a case, the 14 began not functioning well, and I didn't feel like I could trust it. I didn't want to deal with compartment syndrome and an extremity, that sort of thing. We were prone, we were pinned, and the patient was 4 liters into a pretty significant EBL case. And the patient, unfortunately, didn't have much of a neck, and I didn't have any access to anywhere where I could easily see or feel a vein. I even looked in the guy's forehead to see if I could do the dreaded forehead IV. And I remember thinking back to my days as a resident in the PEDS cath lab. So desperate times call for desperate measures. I put in a popliteal vein cortis under ultrasound. Was it ideal? No. Did my colleagues think I was a bit nuts when I suggested it? Likely so. But did it save the patient's life? Quite possibly, because that 4 liters turned into a lot more. And so something I learned as a CA2 in a 3-week-old baby came back a decade later when I was taking care of a non-3-week-old baby coming for a major spinal fusion. And Jed, you and I have talked about this a lot in our residency program. As a trainee, I feel like I seeked out a lot of the more challenging cases. I'd often hear about a case that nobody else was excited about doing. I remember a patient who had an infected aortic graft, and the patient had a dozen antibodies and 8 compatible units in the entire East Coast, 8 units of red cells that the guy was compatible with before he would start hemolyzing. And of course it was infected, we couldn't use Cell Saver. And I heard about the case, and the case had been delayed for 3 days so we could get all the units in-house. And I requested to be put there. My co-residents might have thought I was nuts, but there's some truth to that. But I did learn a ton about everything happening on all sides of the drapes. And I was curious and I paid attention. There are some days where all I want to do in the OR is sit and read a book, but I'm truly terrible at that. I feel like I'm always asking my surgeons, why did you take a certain approach? What makes you want to do this robotically rather than lap or open? I'm asking about different equipment. Why are you using bipolar versus monopolar? I'm asking about indications for various interventions. Why are we doing this pheo retroperitoneal rather than intraperitoneal? I'm not saying that to be an outstanding clinician, you need to go to every case and never sleep and always be on call and drive yourself to the ground. Far from it. But what I am saying is that often great experiences aren't presented on a silver platter. There's a small layer of wrapping paper on top of it. So I tell all of our trainees, do the hard work, ask the hard questions, and seek out those challenges.
Yeah, so much gold in what you just said. So let's go back over some of it. One, seeking out hard cases, a definite theme in what you just said, and I couldn't agree more. I think part of the reason a lot of people don't do that is they're afraid that the failure rate is more likely in hard cases. Let's just look at a very obvious thing. If you had to pick, are you going to do the as a resident, you know, do you want an intubation where you're likely to fail, or do you want one where you're likely to nail it? Whatever people may say, what a lot of people feel is they want the one they're going to nail it because they feel like they're being evaluated by their attending. They want to nail it so they look good. I always tell residents, I hope you don't nail it. I hope you struggle with this airway and this A-line and this IV. I hope you miss it maybe a time or two first, because that way you're going to learn. And if you nail it, then I have nothing to help you with, right? I can't give you advice other than great job, and that doesn't help you. So we really, I think as faculty, we all need to work on this of making our residents believe when we tell them. We want you to embrace the struggle, knowing sometimes you may fail. And I know you're going to talk about failure as an important thing, so we'll get back to that. But that is really key. You mentioned talking to surgeons. And this is, you know, people will say, oh, in anesthesia, you know, I'm all alone in the OR. And I always say, no, you're not. You're never alone in the OR. There's always a surgeon, right? You may be the only anesthesia provider in the OR, but you are not alone. And talking to the circulator, talking to the surgeons, just like you said, Dave, asking them what they're doing, you can learn about them as people, and you can learn about the surgery. And this can be really helpful. So, you know, for whatever reason, there is often this feeling like, oh, I don't want to breach that barrier. I don't want to, you know, talk unless I have to.
You can call it the blood-brain barrier. That's okay.
Yeah. I would never call it that. But I think that's really important. Now, a couple of the actual techniques you mentioned. So doing central lines in plane, I assume you're talking about an IJ. I do this too. Glad to hear you do. I don't always do it, but I do like it. So let me ask you, when you're doing this, do you first go out of plane, visualize the carotid and the IJ, and then turn your probe in line on the vein, kind of go back and forth so you know which one's the carotid, which one's the IJ, and then place it that way? Or what's your technique?
So I usually will find the carotid and IJ in short axis, mm-hmm. and then I'll switch into long axis and then do the entire cannulation just like I'm doing a nerve block. Yep. So needle come in from the side of the probe and watch the needle path the whole time. The dirty little secret is that I use a butterfly probe, and this is not an endorsement for a butterfly probe, but the butterfly allows you to do what's called biplane imaging. So you can see both planes at the same time. And so I can see the long axis on the top of the screen and the short axis of the vessel in the bottom of the screen. So I can make sure that I'm in midline on short axis, but that I see the path of my needle in the whole direction on long axis. I think if nothing else, we do in-plane technique for truncal nerve blocks, for brachial plexus blocks, for all these other peripheral nerve blocks all the time. Why not use it for ultrasound-guided vascular access? I did a large bore peripheral last week with one of our CA3s in plane on ultrasound in the anticube. And she was like, you can do that? And I said, how would you do a tap block? And she said, oh.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the other nice thing about, and I don't have a butterfly. Also, we are not sponsored by Butterfly, but again, open to those discussions if Butterfly is listening. But the other thing about that probe is it looks more like a cardiac probe, right? So it's smaller. If you're using a traditional linear probe, it, depending on the size of the neck, sometimes you can't do it in plane. Just you don't have enough real estate. But often you do. So that's something to keep in mind.
I also happen to be left-handed. And so for me, doing a right IJ in plane is actually great because when I drop my hands, if I'm dropping my hand out of plane, my wrist often hits the patient's chin. But if I'm in plane, it's actually much more ergonomic for me as a left-hander to stand on the patient's right-hand side and do my IJs in plane instead of standing at the head of the bed. I stand on the right arm.
Yeah,
fabulous. Not on the right arm.
Now, you also mentioned a supraclavicular approach to central venous access. So give a quick description of how you do that.
Yeah, so instead of finding the subclavian vein on ultrasound very distal, which is what we often end up doing if you're doing an ultrasound-guided subclavian approach, you can take your probe and you can scan down from the carotid and IJ. And then once you scan down in the IJ, if you go right above the clavicle, you'll see that your IJ is in short axis and it looks like a donut. And then you'll see the subclavian vein coming in from the lateral to medial direction, and it's in long axis. And so a lot of the time, we can't see the subclavian vein as it's going under the clavicle because you get acoustic shadowing from bone, but you can see it if you're above the clavicle and pointed down to the chest. So I'll start at the carotid IJ and then scan down until I see the innominate beginning, aka the subclavian vein joining the right IJ. And then you can cannulate in plane the subclavian vein pointing down towards the innominate. It works really well in patients for whom they have IJ stenosis and have scarred extremities everywhere. And it's sometimes helpful in traumas also because I worry a lot about the cordis being able to make the big turn, especially subclavian cordis placed in the middle of the clavicle, being able to make the turn down. And so with your supraclavicular approach, you're angled down towards the SVC. So it's often easier to make the turn. And it's in plane, so you're less likely, at least in the literature, to cause a pneumothorax and higher likelihood of first pass success.
Yeah, I agree. I've done that as well. And I would say the one thing to watch when you have that ultrasound view is every once in a while, especially with patients maybe with severe COPD and in hyperinflated lungs, you actually can see the lung between your probe and the vessel, which would make that a bad choice, right? So you do want to look for that. If you see that lung sliding, then you may not want to go that route, but it can be a great
approach. Then you could also put in a chest tube at the same time as putting in an IJ through the same hole. It's beautiful.
That's right. Absolutely.
Don't do that. Don't do that.
That is not a true recommendation. Okay. So some great clinical pearls there. And I should just say, you know, none of this is meant to be, you heard Dr. Berman say this on ACRAC, you're going to go do it on your next patient. Certainly not if you're a trainee, but these are things that you may want to look more into, try with appropriate supervision. If you are an attending and you think you can try this or, you know, start looking into it, then that's certainly up to you. But I would recommend that, you know, you feel prepared from more than just hearing it from us before you go do it yourself for the first time. Okay, fabulous. So Dave, let's move on to your next piece of advice.
Yeah, so speaking of that, you mentioned self-directed learning for senior people, for attendings and people who want to try out new things. I share an office with probably the best clinician I've ever met in all of my training. Dr. Scott Mittman, he's led many lives. He's a Harvard and UCSF educated MD, PhD, funded investigator. He was residency program director at a small program called Hopkins, you may have heard of it. And he's now a clinician educator par excellence. He's 20 plus years my senior. But one of the things that I've always grown to respect from Scott is his insatiable curiosity about everything. He's got an incredible intellectual curiosity that I found rare in faculty. We've all had attendings who practice medicine the exact same way that they were taught in residency, even when the evidence basis or commonly performed techniques or surgical approaches change. And we've all worked with these kinds of folks on the other side of the drapes as well as in the ICU. And Scott's insatiable curiosity is the perfect antidote. One of my young attendings from residency once remarked to me towards the end of my CA3 year that I was almost a finished product, which I think he meant very much as a compliment. But rounding up to a decade out of residency, I'm certainly no closer to being a finished product. I feel like I learn new things every day. I trained before ultrasound was ubiquitous for arterial lines and for challenging peripheral vascular access. And I've had to gain increasing familiarity with new technologies as they're being developed. My wife laughs that my time in bed reading journal articles at night is my catch-up time. But there's a lot of truth to that. As a resident, I never used IV methadone. I never used peripheral dose norepinephrine. And now they're part of my everyday practice. Sure, some things fall by the wayside, many justifiably, but many other things join as tools in that toolbox. So I try to do something that pushes me slightly beyond my comfort zone on a regular basis. And I encourage our trainees to do the same. I feel like that has paid dividends for me for the last decade or so. And when our Hopkins residents graduate, Jed, you and I have both said this to people. I wish them the blessing that they should always keep changing their practice. I wish them the humility to know that what they think is true today might turn out to be wrong tomorrow, and that they should totally feel the freedom to be lifelong learners. I tell them that I don't purposely tell them lies, but there's a decent chance that at least some of the stuff I'm telling them is going to prove to be incorrect. And I remind them that I'll be disappointed in them if they practice 30 years from now the exact same way that I taught them to practice now.
100%. Stay with us. We'll be right back. All right, and we're back with some of my responses to Dr. Berman. Yeah, and I'll say a couple things. So Dr. Mittman, as you said, fabulous educator. In fact, he and clinician, he won the Best Clinician Educator Award so many times that we named it after him and forbid him from winning it anymore. And some may wonder, why are we not having Scott on as a master clinician? Well, we will be. He is booked, so stay tuned for that. I'll also say I couldn't agree more. I think that if you can't give a talk 10 to 20 years into your career about all the ways your practice has changed since you finished residency, then something is wrong. That you should, I recommend to all the trainees and young faculty out there that you start now thinking about taking notes on that talk as you go, so that every time you learn something new, jot it down. Say, oh, this is something I'm going to change how I practice a little bit. And if you find you're not adding anything to that list, then something's not right, because there should be things. There's, as you said, there are major ways in which I've changed my practice over the past 10 years, and that is how it should be. And if you're not doing that, then you may be missing the ways in which we are discovering new things and realizing the evidence is pointing us in other directions. So I couldn't agree more there. All right. So Dave, what's next? What else do you recommend people think about?
I think another really important aspect of being a great clinician is to be a human. And as a clinician, the people I respect know that they're people with emotions, right? My wife and I spend a lot of time talking with our young kids about labeling their often complicated and, as you know, often simultaneous feelings. And I do the same thing in the perioperative world, and it's of really critical importance. I've been in some very difficult cases with tragic outcomes over the years, and humanizing and verbalizing the feelings I'm feeling is something which has always paid off. And I don't just mean the trauma who dies on the table. When we hear news about someone's frozen section, which shows up to have some unexpected but catastrophic diagnosis, that hurts. And those things happen all the time. And if you think about it, it especially hurts that you know their diagnosis and all of its terrible prognosis far before the patients and their families do. And I verbalize my feelings out loud for all to hear in the OR, both displaying my feelings and letting them know that displaying theirs is not a sign of weakness, but rather is a sign of strength. I've had plenty of medical students on the other side of the drapes come up to me after a case and thank me for creating a safe space for them to feel and be human while in our grueling schedule. And there's something to be said for that. It doesn't make you a better technical clinician, but embracing the humanity and the emotion in what we do, I think, makes you a better leader and a better person.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I would also say that people feel this in different ways. So if you are someone who is comfortable and wants to express those feelings in the operating room or in the clinical setting, 100%. You should realize that that is not a weakness. Some people may feel like that's not the place or the time for them to do it. They may see a therapist and kind of let those feelings out there. They may go home and share it with their significant other. So I also don't want people to feel like, you know, if you don't express it in the moment, you are somehow repressed or not doing it. I think you have to find what's comfortable for you. But your point, which I completely agree with, is that you should feel like that aspect of feeling the emotions that go along with our work does not only does it not make you a weak person or physician or clinician, but actually a stronger.
But totally. I think it adds a dimension to the clinical work that we don't often think of when we think about a great doctor.
Absolutely. All right. So let's revisit this question of how important it is to be okay with failing. It's such an important lesson, and you mentioned it before, so let me ask you to elaborate.
Yeah, I used to take missed procedures very seriously, and I would also take them very personally. Like, that stupid radial artery was just messing with my day. That dura was just begging to have a hole in it. How could I have avoided that wet tack when the patient kept moving like that? There's no way I could have gotten the epidural in, right? Now I feel like I relish a challenge. It's a thrill to rescue a resident from a challenging neuraxial or vascular access catastrophe or an airway or whatever. I'm not going to say it's always fun and joy, especially at 2 a.m. And I'm also not going to say that I never feel frustrated. That's human. But I remind residents that when I was a CA1, on my neuro rotation, I missed 42 A-lines in a row. My wife would ask me how my day was, and I would just respond back, 37. It was awful. But since then, I've not had a similarly long run of A-line misses, but I've certainly learned to embrace failure as a teaching moment. I love calling in colleagues for help when I'm struggling with something. And I've done this for you. To you, I've certainly done this to a lot of other clinicians at Hopkins. I love watching someone I respect approach the same clinical scenario in a different way. I find that I'm still learning something every single day. It's maybe a touch of an ego hit, but I get so much more out of it than I get than is the downside of the small ego hit.
Absolutely. And I tell our residents all the time that I ask for help all the time, whether it's in the ICU or in the OR. You, one time that I can think of specifically, came and I was struggling, couldn't get the A-line in, and you got an A-line in the foot, right? So, you know, it is absolutely crucial that our trainees see when those of us who are, you know, on the more senior side of our careers also still ask for help, right? That we struggle, that we ask, so that it is not a weakness. Asking for help is actually a sign of strength, because it shows that you're confident enough in yourself that you're willing to put the greater good before your own ego. It's hard, especially when you're young, where you feel like the pressure is you must be able to do it all yourself. But no one will look down on you for asking for help. In fact, people will respect you for it.
And I think that the people who I judge when they call an anesthesia stat are the people who didn't call an anesthesia stat. I think Absolutely. That's the important thing, right? That I've never regretted calling a stat. I've regretted not calling a stat a few times.
Absolutely. And of course, we tell our trainees when they first get out of their orientation that we would much rather that they call. And for those out there who have a different term for it, anesthesia stat for us is essentially all attendings, please respond as soon as possible to this OR. We need help emergently. And we tell them, listen, there's never going to be a time where anyone's upset with you for doing that. But if you don't do it and the patient gets hurt because you were trying to fix it yourself as an early CA1 when you could have called for help and you didn't, then that's a big problem. So don't ever feel like you can't call for help.
Oh, totally.
All right. What else do you feel about the kind of thinking about failure and how we can learn from it?
Along with embracing failure, I have also learned very much to respect failure. And as a trainee and now as a faculty member, I'm not going to say I don't pay attention at grand rounds, but the conferences that I pay the most attention to is during our M&M or patient-based learning discussion conferences. One of the many things that we've learned as a specialty from aviation is doing a deep dive of our outcomes and creating system-wide changes so that these events are one-time things. I similarly learn things every time I cover the MH hotline. How people handle challenges, what works, what doesn't, and taking what I can from each individual case. I scour the literature for every closed claims publication I can get my hands on, and I review them to see whether my practice is reflected in the literature. So before putting a peripheral line onto a pressure infuser, I perform a bubble study, not the one you think. I put in agitated saline and I look on ultrasound either in the right heart or in subclavian vein or brachial vein or something like that, axillary vein, because I want to make sure that I see bubbles and that there's a connection between the IV that I'm putting on pressure and a big central vein. I'm not looking for a PFO. But the brachial compartment can take a lot of volume before it develops compartment syndrome. And the thermocore doesn't know that your line pressures of 300 millimeters mercury are due to an infiltrated RIC line and not that you put a 20 gauge on pressure. Doing these things as a routine is way easier than not doing them and then needing to do a fasciotomy. And when I was a resident, on call during quiet nights, I would take the drawers in our fiber optic cart and I would build myself a little obstacle course. So I'd practice moving my bronchoscope around obstacles. I'd practice going through airways. I'd practice steering, manipulating around a 3D space. And when I was a fellow and a new attending, I would go to our sim center and I would play with a bronchoscopy simulator when things weren't crazy on the floors or in the OR. And I feel like I got good at the rare but rescue-worthy interventions. And when I was a CA3, I did a TTE rotation during my elective time, and it was among the highest yield rotations I did. I got my hands on more than a dozen TTE exams every single day, some of them outpatients, some of them inpatients, some of them sick hearts, some of them normal hearts, some of them LVAD patients. And I feel like I got to learn image acquisition from the techs and interpretation from the cardiologists. I did a lot of extra time in cardiac anesthesia, and I got good at basic TEE. I passed the TEE boards, and like rescue echo, like large bore ultrasound guided peripheral IV access, like rescue bronchoscopy, these have the potential to make a diagnosis that save lives. I think you, Jed, certainly know this. I am also known in the ORs and on L&D for having the worst clinical luck in the entire world. Aortic injury during laparoscopic entry? Sure. Anaphylaxis? Had it on July 3rd with my preceptees last year. inadvertent extubation of a difficult airway by a surgical team with the head away? Yup. I've seen some really awful things in some unexpected scenarios. They weren't fun in the moment, but they made me better.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to touch on one clinical point because I think it's such a great one, which is this happens a lot where we place maybe an AC, IV, might be a RIC or it might just be a regular IV. Could be in the upper arm, could be in the lower arm. But, you know, in the hand, it's pretty easy to see, is it in or not? You know, you inject some saline and if it, you can kind of see it puff up, okay, the IV infiltrated. But if it's further up in the arm, it can be very hard. And so we often have this happen and you have to make the decision. Do I use that IV during the case or do I even put a pressure bag on it or, you know, a thermocore, a massive transfusion device of some kind, a level one? And so the technique you described, I think, is a great one. If you have a cardiac probe, then obviously you can look at the right heart and feel like you see that agitated saline. And just for folks who haven't done this, and Dave, tell me if you do it differently, but it is important. I think what I do is I take two syringes with saline. I let a little bit of air into one of them and then put it on a stopcock so I can agitate them back and forth. Now I've got a bunch of agitated saline with little micro bubbles, and I inject that into the IV while looking at the right heart. Okay. But if you don't have a cardiac probe, which is often the case, but you do have a linear probe, then what I hear you saying is you can look at the subclavian vein. So tell me, first of all, is that how you do the agitated saline? And second, if you're looking for the subclavian vein, what view do you go for? Where do you try to see it so that you can see that agitated saline passing through?
So I, the best way to agitate saline is just to scream at it. So I agree with you. I put two stopcocks and two syringes, one empty, and then one 10 cc's of saline with a touch of air. And then I just squirt back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And I have found that especially if I put in the peripheral IV under ultrasound, I just use the vascular probe. And then I put the vascular probe in the armpit and I set the depth to max. And then I see if I can find the axillary vein at the level of the armpit. If the arm's already out. And so especially if it's a good foot away, that's a pretty good way to confirm that your IV's in. And then I will agitate the saline and I'll have someone hold the ultrasound probe. And when I inject the agitated saline, you should see the vein light up and then you should see it stop. The other good thing about doing this peripherally via the brachial or axillary vein is that you can also compress the vein on ultrasound. So you find your target, you just compress the vein on ultrasound and your spontaneous drip should stop. And I usually tell our trainees that I confirm RIC lines two ways. The first by putting a tourniquet as high up as I can get it and watching the drip stop. And the second is with a bubble study. And if I don't have the easy tourniquet, then I'll just compress the vein with the ultrasound, watch the dripping stop, let go of the pressure, watch the dripping start again, and then I inject my agitated saline. I see a snowstorm in the vein, and then I'm good to go. And I do that. A lot of the time, our arms are tucked. A lot of the time, we don't have easy access under the drapes, especially if it's an upper abdominal case. If it's a hepatobiliary case, good luck getting to a parasternal view when you have your surgical retractor equipment in the way. So I find that doing these things as a routine rather than doing them as a rescue is a really good way to avoid presenting your case at M&M. Yep. I tell my wife in the morning two things. But when I wake up, I say, I won't do chest compressions today, and I won't present my cases at M&M. And I'm usually right about both of those things. Not always, but I'm usually right.
Always a good goal. All right, let's turn to your subspecialty area, OB anesthesia. Do you have any insights from your time on L&D that you would recommend people think about?
Yeah, I spend a lot of time at L&D, and it's an area I love mostly because I get to build deep connections with a relatively limited number of people. Much like in the cardiac anesthesia world or the peds anesthesia world, I feel like I've worked with the same few dozen nurses, OBs, MFMs, OB residents for years, and I've built up a good relationship with them. And there's trust in that relationship on both sides. When I get a notification, when my phone starts blaring about a stat section for a patient with a cord prolapse, I'll often suggest doing a quick lateral single shot rather than GA if the fetal heart rate's normal. I've built up the trust with the OBs and nurses for the last couple of years, and I pulled my data from the last 5 years in our dashboard, and 90%+ of my stat sections in patients without existing neuraxial are done under spinal. And yeah, I'm fast with the spinal, but most importantly, I feel like I've established a trusting relationship with those around me. And along with that trusting relationships comes trusting someone when they're concerned. If one of our L&D nurses is worried about something, I go to the bedside with them, even if it doesn't concern me. I show face, validate their emotions, and I'm sure you do the same thing in the ICU, right? Telling people that their intuition matters is a good way to build connections. And on the labor floor, there are two non-technical things that I do during labor epidurals. One is to play whatever music the patient requests. So I have my Apple Music subscription, and that's for the win. Again, not a subscriber. I'm not a sponsor, but interested. And I feel like I get to know patient stories. I ask them what they do for work, what they do for fun, how they met their partner, if they have one with them. And asking those questions has very occasionally backfired and led to some hilarious stories. But I've gotten to know that there are some incredible people. I get to know them very well by stabbing them in the back. And from that was a joke. From very technical perspective, there are a few things I've gotten skilled at which might set me apart. I do a lot of our placenta accreta spectrum cases. And those are sometimes planned, but sometimes a surprise accreta. And so I've gotten pretty good at putting in Rick lines under drapes, putting in a large bore peripheral under the drapes, giving a liter of blood a minute to a bleeding percreta is empowering. And the best way to get good at these technical skills is to do them and do them frequently. Seeking out those opportunities makes you better. Another thing from a technical perspective, for labor epidurals, if the patient's even a little uncomfortable, I err on the side of a labor CSE. There are, and I know you've discussed this in the podcast before with a couple of my colleagues and my mentors. There are some haters and doubters who say, well, how do you know if your labor epidural works? And, oh, sure, that's great if you enjoy stat sections from tachysystole. And why would you assault the dura? The evidence doesn't support that. And they're allowed to be wrong. If the patient is comfortable before you leave the room, it goes a long way in building a trusting relationship, not just with the patient, but with their nurse and their obstetrician. And just yesterday, I was on L&D, and I was told that there was a patient with a prior C-section who presented fully dilated, pushing, very uncomfortable. She had been scheduled for a repeat C-section today. She did not want to try her labor after C-section. I get into the room. I'm told by one of the nurses, there's no time for an epidural. I say, hold my beer. I say to the patient, would you like a spinal or an epidural? We can try it. And she said, I had two failed epidurals during my last delivery, necessitating a GA section. So I came into her labor room. I asked whether she wanted to try it. We did a lateral single shot. It was me and one of our fellows. And it wasn't traditional. It was safe, right? And it built up the trust between her team, the team, the OBs and the nurses. And she delivered about 20 seconds later. And I made myself a new best friend. She gave me a hug yesterday afternoon.
Yeah, that's fabulous. And I think one of the things you said that I just want to reemphasize is trusting and building relationships with our entire care team in the ICU. If we didn't rely on our amazing nurses and their insight and their intuition, we would be in big trouble. They are invaluable to the care of the patient and to helping us learn what we need to know and know what their concerns are, because they're paying attention to the patient and with the patient much more than we are. I'm sure the same goes on L&D. I'm sure it goes, it's true everywhere. So, you know, really thinking hard about, are we, and we're busy, it can be easy to forget this, but are we making sure to listen to and value the input of all those around us? All right. So those are some great insights from L&D. We've talked a little bit already about the main OR. Anything to add in terms of insights from the general operating room?
Yeah. When you're in the main OR, especially at a place like Hopkins, it's really difficult to know everyone's names and roles. And it's also difficult every July when people switch roles and trainees become attendings. And especially in our era of staffing shortages, our circulating nurse cohort is varied. Some of them are travelers. It's really difficult. And building a cohesive team atmosphere is challenging. We have 100 plus anesthetizing locations at Hopkins alone. It can become a real challenge. And one of the things that my mentors in residency used to do was to reach out to every surgeon the night before. He introduced himself, discussed the anesthetic plan, asked about a surgical plan. Sending those emails is helpful because the surgeons often have an idea for how a case will go that's not clarified in our EMR. I think this is going to be a bloodbath and I'll likely have to reconstruct the pleural vein, right? But it also gets rid of the anonymity. That anonymity breeds hostility. If a surgeon gets an email from me the night before, they know that I'll be motivated to get into the OR early and provide the best care that I can to the patients. Building up those relationships is not easy, but it pays off in spades down the road. And it's especially gratifying when those same surgeons ask you to be their anesthesiologist when they are the patient. And I take the timeout process seriously. I encourage everyone in the room to introduce themselves during our timeout. I know the attending surgeon's name, but often I don't know the name of our medical student on the surgery clerkship. We've all been in rooms as medical students where we are 110% sure that nobody in the room knows our name. And I try hard to avoid those moments. Parenthetically, talking with the medical students on their surgery clerkships is a really good way to recruit them to apply into anesthesia. And as an educator, I work a lot with medical students, and I'm not so great about remembering names on the first go around, but my pants are. Every morning with a student, I write their name on the left side of my pant leg with a Sharpie. And if you work at Hopkins and you've gotten a pair of scrubs with a name scrawled on the left leg, I'm sorry about that. But that way, I at least remember the medical students' names, and I refer to them by their names.
Yeah, it's so crucial. I am terrible with remembering names. I'm one of these people where you tell me your name for the first time, it literally goes in one ear and out the other. So I try to do the same thing you do. I try to write it down if I can. And the other thing I love is I wear my name on my scrub cap. We try to get a lot of people in our department to do that. We give our residents all scrub caps with their names on the front. And I actually ran into one of our surgeons recently who said they're trying to get this throughout the entire surgical arena so that all surgeons and nurses and anesthesiologists and everybody would have their name on their scrub cap. And so that would be wonderful because I think knowing people's names, as you say, really facilitates conversation and discussion and communication. The other thing that I also do is I always write our surgeons the night before each case to get their input and to make sure we establish that communication. If I have a resident with me, I copy them on the email and I introduce them. So the surgeon knows, okay, this is the resident who's going to be with me. And often surgeons will write back and copy their resident or fellow or whoever. And so we have the whole team involved the night before. And I really think it makes a big difference with communication and collegiality moving into the actual operating room the next day. So I second all of that. Dave, this has been fabulous. So much good stuff here. How would you kind of wrap it all up for people? What words do you want to leave people as they go home?
Yeah, I hope this has been a helpful overview of my journey from a trainee to a clinician educator and some of the stuff that's in the back of my head. I try really hard to stay hungry and stay foolish, to find the wisdom in the unexpected places, and to build strong and deep connections with those around me. It's certainly been quite a ride. And I'm very grateful to work with people at Hopkins who tolerate my endless supply of dad jokes. I'm most grateful to our resident team at Hopkins, whose optimism and excitement for learning reminds me, even on the most challenging of days, why our job sometimes is simply magical.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Let's turn to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. Do you have something you would recommend the audience check out for fun?
Yeah, I love Trader Joe's chewable candies. And so they have these these swimmers, these Scandinavian swimmers, then they have the sour ones. But they came out with cinnamon dragons, which are chewy candies, but they're a little bit on the spicier end of things. And I just love the cinnamon dragons. I told my wife yesterday to just buy the entire stock from Trader Joe's because they are just delicious. The best.
Sounds exciting. All right. And I'm going to recommend a podcast called Honestly. It's from an organization called the Free Press, which is run by a woman named Barry Weiss, and they do an incredible job. This podcast is worth checking out. They have really interesting pro-con debates. They interview experts in different fields. They're not afraid to, they do not shy away from controversial topics, and they are not afraid to have guests on who may have controversial opinions, but they are not advocating for those things. They're just think that everything should be debated and that we need to hear from all sides in order to make informed decisions. And so, you know, there's a long list. If you look up their podcast, you'll see lots of different ones. Some of my favorites from the past year or so are discussions about cell phone use in tweens and teens, very near and dear to my heart as I have a tween and a teen, as well as just thoughts on general bringing up children in today's environment and how we can think about trying to make them the best adults they can be with different experts. Really, really worthwhile to check out the podcast, honestly. All right, Dave, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me again. Appreciate it.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at ACRAC Podcast. And you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/acrac. That's patreon.com/accrac, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/acrac. Or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Sonia Amanat is our tech lead, and Sophia Wu is our social media manager. William Mao is our production assistant. Thank you so much for the great work that you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. That is it for today. For the ACRAC Podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Are you looking for legit ways to make extra money? Our friends at The Side Hustle Show have put together this cool free 60-second quiz to help you do just that. All you got to do is go to hustle.show. You can do it right from your phone. Answer a few short multiple choice questions, and it'll recommend a few episodes of the hit Side Hustle Show podcast to start with. You can add your personalized Side Hustle Show playlist to your device, learn what works, and start making more money today. Again, that's at hustle.show, or follow the award-winning Side Hustle Show in your favorite podcast app.